Welcome to the Crime Victims and Criminal Records Division Committee. The quorum is present. Representative Castle, would you like to move the minutes of the previous February 27th meeting?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
I understand we have an amendment to the minutes. The amendment to the minutes would be the minutes of Friday, February 27th, rather than February 7th. All in favor, say aye.
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 Carry. Okay. First bill on our agenda today, we will take up House File number 1245 with Representative Simon. Representative Olin, would you like to move Representative Simon's bill?
I'll move his bill and refer it to your committee. And it'll and refer it to public safety policy.
Thank you, Representative Olin. Representative Simon, welcome to our committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Okay, thank you, Representative Steve Simon. Thanks a lot, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate your time. House File 1245 basically does three things. I'm just going to describe in broad brushstrokes what it does and then turn it over to the folks who have really spent a lot of time in the trenches on these issues. The first thing that House File 1245 does, and you can check it out on the actual text of the bill on lines 2.3 and 2.4, it makes clear what wasn't entirely clear before, and we think should be, which is that domestic abuse laws implicate those who have been not only in a significant romantic or sexual relationship presently, but also in the past. As I think we all know from common sense and just as news consumers, that's often a big part of the problem. So that's the first thing that it does. The second thing that it does significantly is down on lines 2.29 through 2.31. And it just makes clear, as the language says, that offenses that can be used in probationary orders can include a conviction for an offense arising out of the same circumstances surrounding an arrest for an offense described under this paragraph. That's a tool that we think will help law enforcement to get at some of the problem. And then the third thing that it does, I'm sorry, I skipped over one, is on lines 2.15 and 2.16. It just makes clear that domestic abuse no contact orders, just like orders for protection, apply throughout the state and not on a jurisdiction by jurisdiction basis. That's what the bill does, members, and I'd like to hand it over for a little bit more context to Michelle Jacobson, and she can introduce herself for the record.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Jacobson, and please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Michelle Jacobson. I'm an assistant Minneapolis City Attorney. I'm here to talk about the provisions in Bill 1245. There's some small tweaks to 518B01, the Domestic Abuse Act, which I think really will help close up some loopholes in the Act and help us as we try and prosecute domestic violence cases and help victims of domestic violence be more safe in their families and homes. The first change that we're suggesting is changes to the definition of a family or household member, and I say change, but really I think it's just a clarification. Right now the statute includes a list of enumerated people who are covered by the Domestic Abuse Act, which means that they're eligible to get an order for protection, and they're also eligible to be protected by domestic abuse laws in the criminal code. That list includes a laundry list of things, including people currently in relationships and formerly in relationships. However, when you get to Subdivision 7, the current statute just talks about people who are currently in significant romantic or sexual relationships, and that's the boyfriend-girlfriend situation. And if you look at the paragraph following that, which is in lines 2.5 through 2.10, they talk about the factors to consider for people who have formerly been in those relationships, whether or not they would qualify under this act. Some judges, however, have found that because the former boyfriends and girlfriends, just to make it shorter, are not listed in Subdivision 7, that they are not protected by this act. We've had judges in criminal cases say that we could not charge domestic assault when they were former boyfriends and girlfriends. There's also a case, I understand, at an appeal at the Court of Appeals in an order for protection case where a judge denied the issuance of an order for protection because it was involving a former boyfriend and girlfriend. And so we think by adding this former language that will more clearly enunciate and clarify that former boyfriends and girlfriends are included under this act. The second change that we're asking, or we're talking about, is subdivision 20, where we would more clearly state that orders, that domestic abuse no contact orders are also covered under the statute. Orders for protection are listed there. Sometimes judges or police officers have concerns and don't believe they can enforce a no contact order that was issued in another county. This slight change would remove any ambiguity about that. And the third change is to the crime of violating a domestic abuse no contact order. There's two changes we're suggesting under that. The first is, right now, domestic abuse no contact orders are defined as no contact orders issued in a criminal proceeding. We're asking that the statute be amended to include juvenile delinquency proceedings. Domestic abuse no contact orders are often issued in those cases, and just right now, the way the statute is written, a juvenile prosecutor would not be able to charge someone with violating a no contact order because it's a juvenile proceeding and not a criminal proceeding. And the third, the second part of that change, we really would like to clarify that domestic abuse no contact orders issued as part of probationary sentences are enforceable as new crimes when the offender violates, no matter what the defendant pled to. And I can give you two just very brief examples of where that has not occurred. Domestic abuse no contact orders are oftentimes issued as probationary sentences. In the cases I'm talking about, the defendant was originally arrested for domestic assault. In one case, he subsequently pled to disorderly conduct. There was another case where a defendant pled to a burglary charge, even though the original arrest was for disorderly domestic assault. In both those cases, judges said that we could not charge as a new crime a violation of the domestic abuse no contact order because the defendant pled to burglary, or in the other case, disorderly conduct, because they were not one of the offenses listed in the statute defining what a domestic abuse no contact order is. And so that's why we're asking that this change be made, so that people, even if they don't plead to a domestic assault, but they were, the offense which they were arrested for was one of the domestic offenses listed in the statute, that they would be able to be charged with violating no contact orders in those cases as well.
Representative Simon, I think that's all we have for now. We stand for questions or comments.
Are there any questions? Yes, Representative West.
I have a question. Sorry, I know I just stepped in the middle of this and probably don't know what we're talking about. But my question is for Representative Simon. Who signs off on a misdemeanor domestic assault charge? Who does that go before for approval?
If I could, I really, on those kinds of questions, would like to defer to those who do this every day. Ms. Jacobson.
Mr. Chair, the police make the original domestic assault arrest, then it goes to a prosecutor to prosecute the case and before the district court eventually. And the court is ultimately the one who makes the decision whether there's enough probable cause to prove a domestic assault.
Okay, Representative Lott. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd like to correct you on that point, actually, that the arrest would occur for a domestic assault, and there is no judicial sign-off on that. You can obviously have an omnibus hearing on a misdemeanor, but a judge signs off on gross misdemeanor or higher. There is essentially a unilateral police prosecutor decision to charge as domestic assault with a misdemeanor, so that's the reason I wanted to ask you that, but just no further questions.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'm struggling to understand why. I understand what you're trying to get at here, but why we're changing the definition of family to perhaps encompass former boyfriends or girlfriends, and how somehow that strengthens you know, the law with regards to trying to stem domestic violence and provide protection for people who've been subject to domestic violence.
Ms. Jacobson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lewin. But I think adding former boyfriends and girlfriends is very important because sometimes the relationship, we're talking about the case where the relationship has recently ended, and while the victim may say that the relationship has ended, the defendant or the offender, I like to define this as my terminology, would sometimes think that the relationship is still ongoing and the harassment will still continue. So I think it's important to include people who are not in relationships anymore because the conduct does not end just because the relationship ends. And that will continue in the future.
Representative Simon.
Mr. Chair, if I could just tag in here. Representative Lewin, I think just from the way that the statute is structured, I understand the concern implicit in your question, but on line 1.118, the definition isn't just family, it's family or household members. And in terms of the backward-looking aspect of the statute, line 1.22 already in present law includes persons who are presently residing together or who have resided together in the past. And then, as Ms. Jacobson was pointing out, this just clarifies some confusion in the statute, because if you look at line 2.7, it already says, this is present law, determining whether persons are or have been involved in a significant romantic or sexual relationship, the court shall consider, and it lists a bunch of factors. And this is just clarifying a tension or an ambiguity in the statute, meaning the portion that I just read implies that you can already look backward at former romantic or sexual relationships, but the statute doesn't say that as clearly. So this is clarifying what the statute seems to imply already. I guess that would be the best answer.
All right. Follow-up question?
Mr. Chair, if you could, that goes to my second question, is what would be considered significant? So significant relationship would be one in which there had been, they were living in the same household at some point in time. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Lewin, it's not necessarily that they would be living together. There are factors listed in the statute that the court can consider, and you look at lines 2.7 to 2.10 to talk about what defines a significant romantic relationship. There is no case law that tells us exactly what it is, but there is the list of factors to consider there. So living together would not necessarily be a requirement. You would weigh the facts you have about the relationship versus the length of time that it has terminated.
All right. Representative Cole.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This language is troubling to me as well. I think I understand the intent of what's going on, but we seem to really be stretching if we're trying to characterize somebody who has been involved in a significant, potentially, somebody who's been involved in a significant romantic or sexual relationship in the past, and pigeonhole that in, shove that into a definition of family member or household member. And also, as the witness testified, you know, this is, there's no time limitation here. And so if I had we can count on the good discretion of the courts, and they typically get it right, but not always. We could be talking about somebody I had a relationship with 10 or 15 years ago and potentially fall under this, and I'm just not sure, Representative Simon, that this is the best way to go about it. If we want to capture, bring within the scope of the statute a certain group of individuals who, you know, are potentially subject to abuse and should be, there should be some protection. I think we've got, this is way too broad. I'm really concerned about the language, I guess I'd be interested in hearing your response, Representative Simon. I mean, maybe there's a way to rework, it's a lot of work, but maybe there's a better way to rework the statute instead of trying to pigeonhole somebody that doesn't make sense to call somebody who I had a relationship with 10 years ago and they never lived with me a family member or a household member. It just doesn't make sense.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Cole, I understand your argument, but I think your quarrel is really with present law, because on line 2.7 it already says right now in law, in determining whether persons are or have been involved. So it sounds like what would make you feel the most comfortable would be an amendment to delete the words or have been in present law, not in this bill. And I understand your argument, which is an intellectually honest argument. I disagree with it, but the problem then is with present law, and we're just trying to make the rest of the statute consistent with what's in present law, which already has seemingly a look-back provision. So we're trying to resolve that tension. Now, there are two ways to resolve it. One way would be the way that you imply, which is, hey, let's not get into this business that he's been looking in the past at all. The other is to do the way that House File 1245 does, which is to say, since there's already a provision in the law that looks backward in time, we ought to make the rest of the statute consistent. Either way would be an intellectually coherent way of doing it. We're just choosing one way.
Representative Cole.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Steiner, I don't think that's what I'm suggesting. I think what I'm suggesting is there's got to be a better way to do it than this. This just doesn't make sense. To characterize somebody as a family member or a household member who is neither a family member nor has ever lived in my household just simply doesn't make sense. I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't bring some of those individuals within the scope of the bill. I'm suggesting that this isn't the way to do it. And I don't know what is. I haven't had an opportunity to, beyond right now to think about this. But I think we need to take a really close look at this, Representative Simon. I don't necessarily oppose what you're trying to do here, and I do see the inconsistency on line 2.7. But we can't call somebody who is neither a family member nor has ever lived with me a family member or a household member. So Representative Simon, I think there's some more work to do here to try to accomplish in a better way what you're trying to accomplish.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see what you mean. I think I get it now. I don't want to put words in your mouth, is that term, you don't mind, it sounds to me, you don't mind the result that would obtain if this bill were to pass, other than the term family or household member seems like an odd one or not broad enough to encompass everything that this list would. You don't mind the list. You're saying it seems a little strange to call someone who might have been a romantic partner, boyfriend, girlfriend 20 years ago to be a family or household member. I guess what I would say is I guess I'd be open to calling that list another term, saying family member, comma, household member, comma, or fill in the blank, if we want to get into that. I think I would personally be amenable to that, unless we're doing this on the fly here, but this is the place to do it, I suppose, unless there's an objection. So if that's really the objection here, not so much what's on the list, but what we call the list, then I would have no objection, Representative Cole, to any language that you or others would suggest.
And Mr. Representative Cole.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Simon, I think we are now talking about the same thing. I think that would be an improvement. I don't know that it's a good idea to do the drafting here on the fly. I suspect this bill has another stop or two. Representative Simon, we can spend some time trying to, craft some language. Now, I guess I would prefer that we do that as it moves to the next committee, because I'd like to have a conversation with you about whether it makes sense, and the advocates as well, whether it makes sense to put some kind of outside time limit on this. I'm not sure that it does or doesn't, but I'd like to have that conversation. So maybe, Representative Simon, I guess my preference would be that we, with your commitment that you're willing to continue to work on this, I'm fine supporting moving this out of here today, but I do think we've got an issue, and whether we, change line 1.18 throughout the bill, that may be a solution that makes some sense.
Mr. Chair, just one thing. I know you have a long list of bills, but right. So it sounds like there are two things that we might want to have an offline discussion on. One is that term that we call this category, whether it's family or household members, and something else maybe, or changing that name. And the other would be some sort of time limit that you want to talk about. So that's really probably a couple issues that we want to talk about. Okay. I'd be open to that.
Thank you, Representative Simon. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Olin renews his motion.
Oh, Mr. Chair, pardon. One more testify.
Pardon me. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Susan Siegel, and I'm the Minneapolis City Attorney, and this will be 30 seconds or less. I just want to thank our author, chief author here, Representative Simon. Domestic violence cases are one of the very most important things that municipal prosecutors prosecute. And as we all know, domestic violence is an escalating crime. So if we can intervene effectively at the misdemeanor and gross misdemeanor level, we are saving lives. And these proposals that were put forward came from our domestic violence team prosecutors. And they were put on our legislative agenda because they have had problems. They have had cases dismissed. One lawyer just had her domestic violence charge dismissed by Hennepin County District Court because of some of the very same issues that will be fixed by these proposals. She was able to get a disorderly conduct conviction, but these are prosecutor-driven. These are not feel-good, let's do something for the domestic violence advocacy community, and we all know that with these really difficult economic times, we can expect domestic violence cases to increase. And so I thank you very much for your thoughtful treatment of this, and I know you've got a big agenda, so I will move on. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Seeing no further discussion, the representative Olin renews his motion that House File 1245 be passed and referred to the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion carried.
Thank you, member.
Representative Rosenthal, are you prepared to proceed? Representative Katz, would you move Representative Rosenthal's bill, House File 1273, for that it be recommended to pass and we referred to Chair Hilstrom's Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight.
So moved.
And that is the motion. Representative Rosenthal, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This is a pretty simple bill. What it does is extends the time from 12 hours to 24 hours when someone can be arrested for committing a domestic abuse crime. And very straightforward. And I'm a testifier who would like to talk to the bill.
Please introduce yourself and state your name for the record. I think you did previously, but I'm sorry I wasn't here, so you could restate it.
Michelle Jacobson, Assistant Minneapolis City Attorney. I'm here just to talk very briefly about the changes that we're proposing to in House File 1273, which would expand the time frame for which a police officer can arrest a defendant on a misdemeanor domestic assault who has fled the scene from 12 hours to 24 hours. And really the impetus behind this bill is to give police officers more time to locate defendants who have fled the scene of a misdemeanor domestic assault and give them time to locate and arrest that person. The reason we're asking for this is really one of the things we know is that the time following an assault is often the most dangerous time for a victim of domestic assault, especially if the defendant realizes the victim called police. The defendant may try and come back and reassault the victim. If police have more time in which they can arrest the victim before they have to wait for the city attorney's office to issue a complaint and a warrant, it keeps victims of domestic violence safer. And really, this will just give police a little bit more time to locate the defendant, actually maybe even take more affirmative steps to try and locate defendants. 12 hours doesn't really give them a lot of time to look for people. If they have 24 hours, it will give them a greater opportunity to locate these defendants and hold victims safer without having to wait for a complaint to issue later on.
Any questions for the bill's author or for Ms. Jacobson? Ms. Jacobson, do you foresee any issues on the 24-hour time limit with respect to evidence, for example, photographic evidence of injuries?
Mr. Chair, no. That information is gathered from the victim at the time of the initial contact with the police. And so if the police arrest the defendant later, it might not even be that they have any further contact with the victim that night. They'll just have the opportunity to locate the defendant and arrest him in a greater time period.
I apologize. I was thinking of different language. So thank you. Any other questions? Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't know if this is a question potentially for you, Mr. Chair, or for staff, but are there other limitations for misdemeanor arrest? I'm trying to remember back to my criminal procedure class in law school. I just don't remember if there are other limitations. I think this is a great bill. I absolutely support it. I'm just curious if whether it's consistent or inconsistent with other practice with regard to misdemeanor arrest when the officer doesn't actually witness the violation.
We always, from my practice, Ripson, of course, we always get an affidavit of a citizen's arrest form from individuals. When we don't have that, it does cause problems for subsequent exclusion of that evidence if there is no citizen's arrest form. But that's more of a police procedure issue. But having been out of this for 2 months now, sometimes I flush. So maybe we should have Ms. Jacobson answer that.
Mr. Chair and Representative Colzer, this is an exception already existing in the law. Generally, a police officer is not able to arrest on a misdemeanor unless it occurs in their presence, unless they have a citizen's arrest form. This bill, as it exists now previous to the changes, allows police officers to do it even though they didn't witness the incident. It just expands the time frame from 12 hours to 24 hours. So,
Mr. Chair, I'm I guess that University of Minnesota Law School education did ring true. I seem to remember that misdemeanors had to be witnessed by the officer for an arrest. So I'm glad I support this bill. I think it's a great bill. I support the change and hope that we can move forward on it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
More support for taxpayer subsidized tuition members.
I paid my own way, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions to Representative Rosenthal's House File 1273? Seeing none, Representative Cass would renew his motion that the bill be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Public Safety, Policy, and Oversight. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Motion passes. Thank you, members. Representative Rosenthal, you're prepared on House File 1546.
Yes, I am.
Thank you, Representative Rosenthal. Please, I guess we need a motion. Representative Olin, would you move Representative Rosenthal's House File 1546?
I move House File 1546 be approved and referred to the Public Policy Committee.
I'll take that as a motion. Representative Rosenthal, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This is a bill that would enhance domestic violence assault for people other than family members. Basically what it does, it says anybody who's committed such a crime in the past 10 years is subject to that enhanced status. I will say that we are currently still working on language for this bill. It's not perfect, but we would like to get it moving and moving forward.
And is Ms. Jacobson testifying to this one as well?
Yes.
Okay. Please proceed, Ms. Jacobson.
Again, Ms. Michelle Jacobson for the Minneapolis City Attorney's Office. We find this proposed change to the law very important. What we think it does is really two main things. 2 years ago in 2007, when the felony domestic assault law was changed, that law was changed to say that if a person has two prior convictions within 10 years, it didn't matter who the victim was, they could be charged with a felony. At the same time, the gross misdemeanor domestic assault law was not changed, and prosecutors were still required to prove that the prior conviction, which we're using to enhance the new arrest to a gross misdemeanor, was against a family or household member. And what that does in reality for prosecutors is it gives us an extra element that we have to prove in our case, and it makes it more difficult for us to charge someone with a gross misdemeanor domestic assault, because we not only have to prove who the victim in the current case is, a family or household member of the defendant, but we have to prove that the defendant had a prior conviction. That's easy. We can get a certified copy of the conviction. The second element, though, that we have to prove that we wouldn't if we were going to try and charge the defendant with a felony, is that the prior victim on that case was also a family or household member of the defendant. And so what we would have to do in some cases is bring in that prior victim to testify who she is and what her relationship with the defendant. And that's very onerous, especially in domestic violence cases, if the prior victim is a former wife who is now in hiding and is not wanting to have any contact with that defendant. And so by removing that requirement, it would allow us to more easily hold offenders of domestic abuse more accountable when they have a new victim on their new domestic assault, a new girlfriend, a new wife, and the prior victim is not that same victim, but someone who is formerly in that relationship. And it would just increase our ability to hold these offenders accountable at a higher level because of their repeated acts of violence.
Questions for Representative Rosenthal or Ms. Jacobson? Seeing none, then Representative Olin renews his motion that the bill House File 1546 be recommended to pass and be referred to the policy, to the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you, members. Is Representative Hillstrom here? Oh, you got up and walked away from your seat so I couldn't see you.
Mr. Chair, I would move that House File 1349 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Public Safety Policy and Oversight Committee.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an agency bill, and so I would like to turn it over to the agency to describe.
Thank you. Go ahead, agency.
Good morning. My name is Suzanne Elwell. I'm the Director of the Crime Victim Justice Unit in the Office of Justice Programs in the Department of Public Safety. And this bill amends Section 611A.0315. Chapter 611A deals with the bulk of all of our crime victim rights. And this statute does three things, and they apply to three types of crimes: domestic violence, harassment, and criminal sexual conduct. And it requires prosecutors to notify victims of those crimes if there's a decision not to prosecute, to provide an explanation for that decision not to prosecute, and to provide information about order for protection and harassment orders. Prior to 2006, this statute only applied to domestic violence victims and harassment victims, and in 2006 we added criminal sexual conduct. Unfortunately, the words criminal sexual conduct crimes only got added to in subdivision 1 to paragraphs 1 and 2, but not 3, which is the provision that says give information to that victim about harassment orders and orders for protection. This bill just seeks to correct what appears to be an oversight in that bill in 2006 and make sure that this right applies equally and to the same extent to all three of these types of crime victims. That's it, Mr. Chair.
Questions for Representative Hillstrom or Ms. Elwell? Representative Massey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Elwell, was there any reason why this was left out in the original draft?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't have an answer to that. I don't think that there was a specific reason that it was left out. There certainly was no opposition to the bill in 2006.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none, are there any testifiers in the audience that wish to be heard on this bill, House File 1349? And I don't see any. So with that, Representative Hillstrom renews her motion that her House File 1349 be recommended to pass and go back to her committee, the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Hillstrom.
Okay. The next bill we have for consideration is House File 1199. Representative Loon, would you like to move Representative Lesher to House File 1199?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move House File 1199 for consideration and approved, moved on to public safety.
Public safety policy. You know.
Public safety policy and oversight.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Lesher, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, why don't I just hand it over to the county attorney, the director at Washington County, Tom Adkins, who can speak to this.
Good morning, Mr. Adkins. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Adkins. I'm the director of Washington County Community Corrections. This morning I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Community Corrections at Counties, which is the directors of those community corrections at counties that handle about three-quarters of the offenders on probation or supervised release in the state. House File 1199 basically amends the definition for who can possess a firearm, and what it what this is aimed at is trying to make it clear that those laws are fairly confusing at times, and in our opinion, as we see this in practice on a regular basis, this would amend 6.4712 subdivision 5, which is the definition for that, and it would add both felony domestic assault as well as assault by strangulation, both of which are felonies. And as we see those in relation to the other crimes of violence that are listed there, they're not nearly as clear. They come under another section of that, and this would make it much clearer in terms of how that's handled. Right now, we deal with who can own or possess a firearm issues that are both state as well as federal, and those laws are complicated, and this would simplify that language and make it much clearer for us as we proceed in those situations. It would also make the possession of a firearm a felony in those cases if they did that. It would enhance the penalty for that on the other end. And as probation officers in the state, we see this as a very good change in the law. So it's pretty straightforward. It's fairly simple for us. We believe that both of those should be considered a crime of violence in this statute.
Thank you, Mr. Atkins. Are there any questions of the bill's author or the testifier? Seeing none, Representative Lewin renews her motion that House File 1199 be recommended to pass and proceed to the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. Carried.
Thank you.
The next bill before us is the House File 1392.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House File 1392 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Public Safety Policy and Oversight Committee.
Thank you, Representative Simon.
Okay, people smarter than me told me it's going to Representative Paymar's Committee, the Finance Committee.
Fine, huh? Oh, yeah,
we need to do that committee. It's a pipeline. So strike that last comment.
All right.
Not the smarter than me part.
Smarter than you?
Yeah. Yeah. All right.
Thank you, Mr. Lesh. Representative Lesh, please proceed.
Okay. Thank you. And Mr. Chair and members, I have some very qualified testifiers on this bill as well. As you can see, it's an omnibus, has omnibus in the title, so I'm just going to hand it over to them.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Caroline Palmer. I'm the staff attorney at the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Thank you very much for considering the bill this morning. I'm just going to give you some brief information and then turn it over to two testifiers who can give you more details on the bill. MNCASA was founded in 1978, currently provides technical assistance and support to over 70 sexual assault advocacy programs statewide. We collaborate with advocates, county attorneys, law enforcement, medical staff, social services, legal services, and many other partners to work together and change systems that we think will better meet the needs of sexual assault survivors. Sexual violence is a significant problem in Minnesota. According to the 2007 Minnesota Department of Health report on the cost of sexual violence, in 2005, more than 61,000 Minnesota residents were sexually assaulted. This number could nearly fill the Metrodome. The report also concluded that in 2005, costs related to sexual violence amounted to nearly $8 billion, or just over $1,500 per resident. With this information in mind, MNCASA has developed our 2009 action agenda in collaboration with its public policy committee. Our agenda is divided into three goals: preventing sexual violence, providing supporting care for victims and survivors, and creating a criminal justice system that helps to stop sexual violence. I will note for purposes of this committee's charge that MNCASA believes sexual violence prevention informs all of the work that we do, and particularly in the area of improving the criminal justice response to sexual violence. The criminal justice portion of our agenda was developed with our Access to Justice Subcommittee. It's a group of prosecutors from several counties and a representative from the Attorney General's office. The subcommittee identifies issues of concern based on their experience and discusses possible solutions, which are then presented to our Public Policy Committee for inclusion on our action agenda. We also identify issues through a listserv that we provide for prosecutors and sexual assault investigators. Occasionally, issues also come to us through cases that sexual assault advocates have handled throughout the state through their member programs, or we also respond to national trends that we're tracking.
Our criminal justice agenda is supported by the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, and there's a letter from them included in your packet. The Omnibus Sexual Conduct Technical Review Bill presented to you today offers small but important technical revisions to the criminal sexual conduct statutes. This is a new process for the legislature and this committee, but we hope it helps to establish a streamlined approach to improving the existing statutes and expanding access to justice for victims. These are changes requested by prosecutors or noted in appellate court decisions. Our intent is not to establish new crimes or recodify the statutes. We would like for this bill to become part of an annual or biannual process coordinated with this committee. We understand that changes to the criminal statutes may well result in fiscal impact. Still, we believe financial challenges do not prevent us from talking about what the state can do to improve the laws governing criminal sexual conduct. So we hope to partner with you to find realistic solutions and to ensure the accuracy of any fiscal notes that result from our proposals. This year's bill has four components, and I'm going to turn over the testimony now to Corey Tennyson. He's an assistant Scott County attorney. He's a member of our Access to Justice Subcommittee, and he's going to provide further explanation on three of the bill's sections. And then Suzanne Allegro from the Sentencing Guidelines Commission will address the portion of the bill that relates to presumptive sentencing for repeat convictions. So thank you again for your time and attention.
Thank you, Ms. Palmer. Good morning. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hello, Mr. Chair and committee. My name is Corey Tennyson. I'm an assistant Scott County attorney. As much as we have specialization in my office, I somewhat specialize in the prosecution of criminal sexual conduct offenses. Really, what I've been asked to speak to today are three parts of the law that are common sense changes. The first is with regard to the statute of limitations, and there is a court case that is in your material that basically was an invitation from the Court of Appeals to have this fix occur. It is a common sense situation. For criminal sexual conduct cases involving children, there is a bit of a nuance in the law that is appropriate. As you can imagine, the prosecution of criminal sexual conduct cases is a very difficult proposition in and of itself, let alone a small child as the victim. And basically what the statute of limitations sets out is that cases can be prosecuted either 9 years after the commission of the offense or 3 years after report to law enforcement. But the court case that you have in front of you basically was a situation which was a bit nuanced, which there were basically two child victims. One reported to law enforcement within the 9 years, one did not. And the situation that happened is that the Court of Appeals basically said that because the case, the charge was not filed until after the eclipse of the 9 years as to the one victim, prosecution was barred. That was the victim that did report. The victim that did not report was in fact able to be prosecuted because of the special exception in the law. What we're seeking to do is basically to avoid an absurd or a non-common sense type result as in that case. And so the proposed language is indictments or complaints for violations of section 609.342 to 609.345, if the victim was under the age of 18 years at the time the offense was committed, shall be found or made as filed in the proper court within the later of 9 years after the commission of the offense or 3 years after the offense was reported to law enforcement authorities.
Excuse me, Mr. Tennyson. I believe you're referring to language contained in an amendment to House File 1392. Representative Lesh, would you like to move the amendment?
I'd love to move that amendment, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Is there any discussion on the amendment?
That's the A1.
A1 amendment?
Yes, A1.
Okay. Hearing no discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Nay. Amendment is adopted. Please proceed.
The next part of the legislation that I was asked to speak of today, again, reflects, I think, what is a mistake or a situation that creates a situation that is not consistent with common sense. And that is that in a gang rape type situation where you had two or more individuals, where you perhaps had One individual who was acting as a lookout or perhaps blocking an exit, something of that nature. Yet another individual who was actually committing the rape. The situation as it currently stands in the law is that the person using the force or coercion to accomplish the rape would in fact be guilty of a lesser charge than the person acting as a lookout or blocking the door. Basically, under the current law, I would be able to charge the actual rapist with only third-degree criminal sexual conduct, which is penetration with force or coercion. I would, however, be able to charge the lookout with first-degree criminal sexual conduct because it was an aid or abet situation and the accomplice, the actual rapist, was using force or coercion. So what we're seeking is basically a technical fix to add to the particular statute, which would basically add in that it could be the actor or an accomplice uses force or coercion. Therefore, if you had a situation that had multiple actors, all actors would be guilty of the same level of offense. And that would be regarding first-degree criminal sexual conduct penetration. The last piece that I was asked to speak of today is with regard to criminal sexual conduct in the second degree and criminal sexual conduct in the fourth degree. And really there was a kind of a famous case for Minnesota and the Twin Cities area involving a University of Minnesota football player that really highlighted why this fix is important. As the law currently stands, criminal sexual conduct includes things like touching breasts, touching vaginal area, things of that nature. Currently, as the law stands, it does not include the intentional emission of semen on another person. So you could, in fact, have a situation where, for whatever reason, a sexual offender is intentionally ejaculating on a small child, a teenager, perhaps at a party, or even an adult in a certain situation where we could not charge a criminal sexual conduct offense. In fact, really the highest level offense we may be able to charge, depending on whether the victim is awake or lucid, could perhaps be an indecent exposure, perhaps a disorderly conduct. These are misdemeanor type offenses. They do not require sex offender registration or felony level probation, things of that nature. And so what we're looking to basically add in the definition of criminal sexual conduct in the second degree, criminal sexual conduct in the fourth degree, is paren 5, which would read, the intentional touching by the actor of the complainant's body or the clothing covering the complainant's body with seminal fluid or sperm.
Thanks, Mr. Tennyson. If you may, Representative Cole, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the witness, this makes complete sense to me. I'm just a little, I'm not sure that the definition that we've got proposed here is the best way to go about doing this. I would be concerned. I understand how the phrase is constructed. I think that if it's, it makes me nervous. If you read it, the intentional touching by the actor of the complainant's body or clothing covering the complainant's body with seminal fluid or sperm. I'm wondering if we need to move that definition around, because I don't think you're talking about criminal sexual conduct if somebody just intentionally touches somebody on their body or clothing. You're talking about touching with seminal fluid or sperm, correct? I mean, that's the intent, at least.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, I believe that, the situation that we are trying to get at is, in fact, an intentional situation of a deposit or an ejaculation of sperm on someone's body. We can look at the specific language, but I think one catch-all, and in fact, when I was speaking with my wife last night about the fact that I was going to be testifying here today, she asked me some questions about this specific provision, and one thing she asked is, what if it's a party-type situation, what if it's a joke, something like that, and I think the catch-all that is in here is, this act must be done to be found guilty with sexual or aggressive intent. So it merely puts this provision in with the rest of criminal sexual conduct context But then there is the requirement that it's with sexual or aggressive intent.
Mr. Chair, if I could, and I hear Mr. Tennyson's explanation of that, I think which is good too. But I think Representative Cole's concern is with maybe the grammatical approach with how it would look in the jury instruction. So maybe if I could ask Representative Cole, maybe on the fly, and the rest of the committee just come up with a word or two that he think would be better, and then we could have that discussion before it moves to the next committee. Is that all right?
Thank you, Representative.
And I wouldn't have a problem with incorporating it if it worked.
All right, Representative Cole.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, you're absolutely correct. It is sort of the grammatical structure of the definition. It's not. I'm fully supportive of what you're trying to do here. I'm just wondering, this may not be grammatically correct either, or may not make sense. But what if we took the phrase with seminal fluid or sperm and inserted it after touching? So it would read with the intestinal touching with seminal fluid or sperm by the actor of the complainant's body or clothing covering the complainant's body.
You know what I'd like to do, if we could do grammatical work like this. I'm sure I wouldn't have a problem incorporating if we came to agreement.
Mr. Chair, Representative Black, I'm happy to, again, I absolutely support what you're trying to do here. I want to make sure that it makes sense. And let's work on this after the committee.
All right, Mr. Tennyson.
That's all I have. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Freddie.
Thank you. Is there anyone else to testify for or against this bill? Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Suzanne Allegro, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and I'm here to talk about Subdivision 10, which is the presumptive executed sentence for repeat sex offenders. When the Sentencing Guidelines Commission designed the new sex offender grid, one of the primary tasks was to increase public safety by imposing harsher penalties on repeat sex offenders. That was accomplished by increasing the weights assigned to the most serious prior first and second degree offenses and by assigning offenders an additional custody status point if they commit a criminal sexual conduct offense while on probation or supervised release for a previous sexual conduct offense. Even so, the Commission was aware that some repeat offenders could fall into the area of the grid where offenders are recommended probation if they are no longer under supervision and if their prior offense was not one of the more serious offenses which receive a weight of 2 or 3. However, at the time, a mandatory minimum for repeat offenders was in effect, so the Commission assumed that those offenders would continue to be subject to that provision. It was always intended that repeat offenders would have presumptive prison dispositions, either because of where they fell on the grid, on the new grid, or because of the mandatory minimum provision for subsequent offenders. Effective August 1st, 2005, the legislature created new mandatory sentencing provisions for sex offenders in 609.3455. At that time, the existing provisions of 609.109 were repealed, including subdivision 3.2, which provided mandatory prison sentences of 36 months for offenders sentenced for first to fourth degree criminal sexual offenses if the offender had been convicted within the previous 15 years of a first to fourth degree criminal sexual conduct offense. This was the provision the Sentencing Guidelines Commission thought would continue to ensure that all repeat offenders would have presumptive executed prison sentences. This proposed legislation will reinstate the 36-month mandatory minimum for subsequent criminal sexual offenses, which was repealed in 2005.
Thank you, Ms. Allegro. Representative Lex, did you have any further comments?
No further comments.
Sure. Okay. Are there any questions of the testifier? All right. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Lex.
Mr. Chair, I'd renew my motion that it be recommended to pass and be referred to Chair Hiltram's Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight.
Representative West recommends the bill be passed as amended.
Thank you. As amended.
Yes, Mr. Speaker. All right. All in favor, say aye.
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 All opposed, say nay. Motion carried. The next bill before us this morning is House File Number 1120. Representative Cass, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, I would, Mr. Chair. I'd move that House File 1120 be recommended to pass and moved on to Chair Hillstrom's Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight.
Thank you, Representative Cass. Please proceed.
This is an agency bill that looks at the comprehensive incident-based reporting system and expands the use in that actual reporting system. So I will turn it over to the agency who will define how this will be used.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself and state your name for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is David M. Johnson, and I am the Executive Director of Minnesota Justice Information Services at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. House File 1120 proposes to change the access rules for law enforcement to the comprehensive incident-based reporting system that is included in Section 299C40. At the present time, access to that system is restricted to law enforcement only for the specific purposes of preparing a case against a person, whether known or unknown, for the commission of a crime or an offense for which the agency has investigative authority, or for the purpose of conducting, for the purpose of background investigations as required by Minnesota Statute 626.87, that is for law enforcement employment. The bill proposes to increase that access to, first of all, serving process in a criminal case, secondly, to inform law enforcement officers of the possible safety issues prior to service of process, thirdly, to enforce no contact orders, and finally, to locate missing persons. And again, it's still remaining within law enforcement. This request was initiated by the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association and the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. It was referred to the Criminal and Juvenile Justice Information Task Force. It was assigned for study to a delivery team chaired by Mr. Jim Rhodes. These proposals came out of that process and then moved up to the Criminal and Juvenile Justice Information Policy Group. That group had significant discussion relative to these proposals in two of their meetings, and again passed those on for legislative consideration. And with that, that concludes my section on this bill.
Any questions for Mr. Johnson or Representative Cass? I have a question. Representative Cass or Mr. Johnson, I don't know if you can help me out here, but what's that little winky smiley face at the end of line 1.11 that we're adding? Or are we striking the comma and adding a semicolon?
Yes.
Okay.
But it is, for the record, yes, a winky smiling thing.
Thank you. That's a technical term, I
yes,
know.
Yes, it is.
Defined in statute elsewhere. Okay. Any other questions? Hearing no questions.
Who made the motion?
Oh, Kath, of course, made the motion. Representative Kath renews his motion that House File 1120 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Kath. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Representative Kath, to your bill 1199. Representative Kath moves. What did I say? Bunch of ones and a nine. 1119 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. Representative Kath, to your bill.
This is just a very basic reorganization of some of the data practices, specifically the names of organizations, so the changes are going to be reflected in statute that way. Before we proceed, though, on page 6, line 6.2, I'd like to incorporate an oral amendment on a very slight technical change. On line 6.2, 13.873, we should strike the 3. So on line 6.2, it should read 13.87.
integrated search services as defined. And then in section 13.87, do we need to get rid of the secondary one? Just the first one.
Okay, so just to be clear, we're changing on line 6.2 from 13.873 to 13.87.
Only on the first one.
Only on the first one.
The secondary one is fine as written.
How wonderfully confusing. Does everyone understand the oral amendment?
Yes.
Okay, there being no questions, all in favor of stated oral amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Cass. Please proceed.
Great. I will turn it over to the agency, and they will kind of outline where these changes are being made.
Mr. Johnson.
Again, Mr. Chair, David Johnson, Executive Director of MNJIS. During the period in 2008, early in 2008, I was brought on to be the Executive Director of the CRIMNET Program Office. And as I entered that set of responsibilities, we were challenged to bring the CRIMNET Program Office, along with the existing organization known as Criminal Justice Information Systems, into a single organization in order, because so many of the duties and responsibilities were connected, and because the organizations were separated, there were some inefficiencies and ineffectiveness that occurred because of that. To that end, we worked for a number of months to unite the organizations and produce what is now called Minnesota Justice Information Services. A component of that reorganization was to do a study of Minnesota statutes to locate where either the term CRIMNET Program Office or Criminal Justice Information Systems appeared in statute, and therefore this reorganization would create confusion as to the responsibilities pursuant to those statutes. To that end, Ms. Katie Engler came over from the Department of Administration and assisted us in an exploration of all of those statutes, and then wrote the various technical corrections that would be necessary to facilitate those changes and bring more clarity to the responsibilities of Minnesota Justice Information Services. And Ms. Engler is present here with me today, and she could certainly speak to any of those technical changes that are included in this bill.
Do people have questions as to the technical changes, members? I don't see any, Mr. Johnson, so... any other testimony on this?
Only to try to do that.
Okay. Are there any questions for Mr. Johnson or for the author by members? And I don't see any. Well explained. So Representative Cass renews his motion that House File 1119 be recommended to pass and re-referred to Representative Hillstrom's Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Do we have any others? Okay. Members, that is for bills on the calendar, and I appreciate you being so awake this morning that we can move through quickly. I would note that it is possible that we may be having another committee time next week. As indicated by the general availability of people, the time to meet is Thursday night, but Representative Hillstrom said that she's meeting at that time, so that would be a problem. And we would never want to step on her toes. So we may need to turn another time next week, and Aaron here will be in touch with you to determine when we can, just to make sure we get through all these bills as deadlines approach. Are there any questions from members about that? Okay, committee's adjourned.